This week, President Obama announced a broad climate action plan aimed to cut carbon pollution. This half hour, we'll talk with a guest about what that plan actually calls for and whether it faces any obstacles. Good morning, I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine. It's 7:36 on Friday, June 28th. The president also says his plan prepares the U.S. for the impacts of climate change and would lead international efforts to address global climate change as well. What questions do you have about President Obama's plan? Do you support the plan? Do you think it's unnecessary? Or are you disappointed that it didn't go far enough? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org. Our guest this hour is, or this half hour, is Michael Kraft, Professor Emeritus of Public and Environmental Affairs at UW-Green Bay. Good morning, Professor Kraft.
Good morning.
How are you?
Could be better, just getting over a cold, but as long as my voice holds up, we're all right.
Okay, well, keep that tea close to you.
All right.
And get well soon. Well, the first step in President Obama's three-pronged approach is to cut down on carbon pollution in America. I'm wondering, who is he primarily speaking to there? Who are the largest perpetrators of carbon pollution?
He's really talking about coal-fired power plants, particularly the older plants. Coal has been diminishing as a source of electricity production in the last 6 or 7 years, as natural gas has been increasingly attractive because of its low price, but it's about 40% of carbon emissions. So he's really zeroing in on coal-fired power plants, which is a big chunk of the greenhouse gas emissions from this country.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been expected for a long time he would do that. He's already done it with new power plants, and this is now directed at older or existing power plants.
How does he expect to work with power plants, or to have the EPA, for example, work with power plants to keep those emissions in check?
Well, what's key to Obama's proposal is he's going to use the powers granted to the Environmental Protection Agency under the Clean Air Act of 1970 to basically issue rules and regulations relating to emissions of greenhouse gases. The Supreme Court has ruled, this was back in 2007, the EPA does have authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. This will be strongly resisted, of course, by the coal industry and possibly by the oil industry as well. So it's by no means easy. On the other hand, the reason Obama is pursuing this three-pronged strategy, we can come back to the other two pieces, is that he has no chance whatsoever of getting legislation through Congress. He has said for years now he prefers that Congress pass a climate change policy that would be a cap-and-trade policy. And the House did that in 2009. The Senate never did. With Republican control of the House now, it's hopeless to expect Congress will enact climate change policy. So what Obama said on Tuesday was it's going to be done through executive action, so Congress need not do anything. But this doesn't mean there are no risks or no opposition. When the EPA is done, and it may take several years, when it finally produces a regulation, I think it's inevitable that the EPA will be sued by the coal industry over this. But this is nothing new. Every major EPA regulation winds up in court. So Obama knows his only chance to leave a legacy, and a lot of people are talking about this as a legacy policy for his presidency, to finally take action on something that is not, you know, it's not in the news on a daily basis, but it's one of those really, really big long-term problems. And that's why he made the speech. If people want to read the details of it, they can go to the White House webpage and look for Climate Change Action Plan, and all the details are there. It's about a 20-page statement on the White House.
And they've got a fact sheet up on their blog, too.
Oh, they got lots of facts there, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The president wants us to be prepared for the impacts of climate change, and that's the second of his three approaches, or three-pronged approach. What sort of things is he aiming for us to be prepared against?
Well, I think as we learned in the case of New York City and New Jersey and with the hurricane, that there's a lot of damage that can be done to coastal communities as we have more severe storms in the future related to climate change. And so the focus here is on preparedness, essentially, emergency response, preparedness, trying to move critical facilities out of low-lying areas. And so the federal government is proposing to help cities and states protect themselves from rising seas and other effects. Climate change. This is a so-called mitigation strategy. If you can't stop climate change, and really it's too late to do it, then at least you avoid the most dramatic consequences by making sure we're prepared for events like, you know, major hurricanes or tornadoes and other events of that sort. So this essentially will mean more federal funds and more encouragement for cities and states to plan for climate change. that's not likely to be too controversial unless it requires spending a lot of money, in which case, because of concern over the deficit and the national debt, there may be some objection from those who don't want to see additional federal government spending.
Right. And FEMA is often, the first responder to large disasters. Yeah. And so I would imagine that a lot of funding would go to that agency. But they also are under a bit of scrutiny for the way they've responded to previous crises.
Yes. I think after the most recent events that we've seen from tornadoes and hurricanes, that there's probably some public receptivity to doing a little bit more. And, economically, it's one thing to say, well, we should spend no more money because it's very expensive. But on the other hand, as New York City discovered, the economic consequences of being struck by a major hurricane and the damage that's done, we're talking about $50, $60 billion. So if you could spend $10 billion to prevent a $50 billion accident, I guess most of us would say that's a reasonable thing to do. And, cities and states will have to figure out exactly what to do. You can't stop the sea from rising, but you can do a variety of things to protect low-lying areas from water infiltration and damage to electrical components and heating and cooling systems and public transit and all of that. And I think the federal government's going to prod cities and states to do a little more thinking about what makes sense and maybe offer some federal funding to help them do that.
Our guest is Michael Kraft, Professor Emeritus of Public and Environmental Affairs at UW-Green Bay. We're talking about President Obama's plan to address global climate change. We're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Professor Kraft, the third of the three prongs, I guess, is that the president also wants the U.S. to lead international efforts to address global climate change. How does this call for action differ as compared to previous efforts by him or previous presidents?
Well, the United States historically has always been a global leader on environmental policy. This diminished, not surprisingly, during the Bush administration. And the Obama administration, even in its first term, really tried to reassert U.S. leadership on these issues. But the U.S. has not taken very many direct or meaningful steps internationally. Policies remain largely what they are. There's a real split among nations as to what to do, how far to go, the timeline. There has always been a split between rich nations and poor nations over who should do what, who's going to pay for it. So what the president is announcing is there'll be additional leadership and innovation on the part of U.S. government, I think, to try to establish some channels of communication. You can really read into this China, because China's the biggest greenhouse gas emitter in the world. And both China and India and a number of other developing countries are rapidly building new coal-fired power plants. So the United States will offer to talk with other countries, maybe to help finance some new technologies, to share information, and to play a bigger and more visible role at international meetings. And I think there's actually a fourth prong as well, which is what the president's already done, which is to invest more money in alternative energy and energy conservation.
Yes.
And in other words, you don't just say we're going to deal with coal-fired power plants, but you're going to encourage new forms of electricity. And in fact, I checked this morning, and just in the last 6 years, coal has gone from 50% of U.S. electrical production to 40%. Natural gas has gone from 19 to 28 because of gas fracking and lower prices. And renewable energy has gone up quite a bit, up to about, if you count renewables and hydropower, about 8%. Nuclear stayed the same. So we're already on that path, and I think the administration, again, wants to spend more money. The president did a lot of that in his first term, more money on new technologies that can slowly move us away from fossil fuels like coal and oil and natural gas. Natural gas is less damaging than coal, but it's still a fossil fuel.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of complex components, I guess, of this approach. First of all, you mentioned that China being a leader, I guess, in the carbon emissions. But the United States has a very complicated relationship with China. So how do you suppose President Obama can get get China on board with this global climate change initiative?
The issue with China and many other countries has always been whether the U.S. is prepared to share technology and make it possible for other countries to move, particularly on things like refrigerants. And part of this has to do with intellectual property rights, but I think what the U.S. would do is to strongly urge, it's the best you can really do internationally, you urge other countries to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, you offer to share information about new technologies You get U.S. companies to maybe sell their products and ideas to China if they can be persuaded to do that. So you're trying to ease the pain of other countries making the same transition. Mm. But what the United States can also do is just set the pace. If we say, you know, we don't care what China and Europe does, this is what we're going to do. We're going to be number one in the world. We're going to develop the technologies. We're going to lead the world, and then other countries may follow. But if the United States holds back, other countries will say, hey, if the United States is doing nothing, why should we do anything? So there is and the president talked about this as a kind of moral imperative that we do something for future generations. And I think that extends to the United States stepping out, even if other countries don't follow immediately.
Hmm. That's Michael Kraft. He's Professor Emeritus of Public and Environmental Affairs at UW-Green Bay. We're talking about President Obama's broad plan to address global climate change, and we're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org or find us on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. If you prefer Twitter, our handle is @JoyCardineShow. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In our weather forecast today, increasing clouds, then rainy. It'll be mild with most highs near 70 degrees. Highs will be in the lower 60s, though, if you are located near Lake Superior. Cloudy tonight with scattered showers and thunderstorms, lows in the mid to upper 50s. And your forecast for Saturday, partly to mostly cloudy with a chance of rain, highs in the lower 70s. I'm Cynthia Schuster filling in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Join us after 8 o'clock for the Week in Review. Two guests from opposing political perspectives join me to discuss and debate this week's top headlines. With a handful of Supreme Court rulings and the U.S. Senate passing a bipartisan immigration bill and a state budget that still awaits the governor's signature, we have plenty to talk about after 8 o'clock on the Week in Review. Right now, we're talking with Michael Kraft, Professor Emeritus of Political Science, or rather of Public and Environmental Affairs at UW-Green Bay. And we're discussing President Obama's call to address and prepare for the impacts of global climate change. We're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org. We'll go first to Freddie in New Berlin. Hi, Freddie.
Hi, Cynthia. Professor Kraft, I want your comments on what do you think of the allegation that this is just a ploy by Obama to offset the Keystone pipeline interest to have that closed down. So he can have his pipeline while having these carbon emissions reductions initiatives passed as well. In other words, it's pulling one interest off on another. What do you think of that?
It was a little hard to hear Freddie's comments, but I think he's asking about the Keystone XL pipeline and how the president might rule on that eventually and how that can be reconciled with his position on carbon pollution reduction. Mm-hmm. The president hasn't yet stated what he's going to do about the pipeline, but in his remarks this week, it began to sound to me like he would like to approve the pipeline as long as he can be convinced it doesn't add to carbon pollution. I don't know how he could be convinced of that, since it clearly will add to carbon pollution. But it looked to me like he wanted to create a little bit of a wiggle room. And the reason for that is he's under a lot of pressure to approve the Keystone pipeline for job creation measures, for relations with Canada. And environmentalists have been solidly opposed to Keystone XL on grounds that if you go down that path, then many other actions to reduce greenhouse gas emissions become much less consequential. So I think it's still too early to know how the president's going to act. He's going to have to decide this year. But it looked to me like he was trying to justify that as long as he can be persuaded that it's not going to worsen carbon pollution.
One layer to this issue might be how the states will handle President Obama's orders here. How effective can his measures be in states where climate change isn't really talked about at all? For example, North Carolina has banned basing their policy on sea level rise.
Yes, right. Well, you know, it's a good reminder, Cynthia, that we live in a federal system, and a lot of people prefer that action be taken at the state or even local level, regional level. And some of the best environmental policies we have are at the state and regional level. California has a very strong climate change action plan all by itself. Now, the president said in his remarks, and you can really see this on that White House webpage, what he's really doing is there's a lot of language there about the EPA should work closely with states and industry and other stakeholders to establish the new standards. So I don't think he intends this as a top-down command and control type of EPA action. I think he intends that some states will do more than other states, that each state's particular situation will be taken into account. Some states may be very, so heavily, and Wisconsin is one of them, heavily dependent on coal-fired power plants that it's difficult for them to, you know, quickly adjust. Other states may find it easier. So I think there'll be a lot of flexibility in here, a lot of long-term planning that will make it easier for states to adapt.
Let's go next to Ruthie in Milwaukee. Hi, Ruthie.
Hello. Thanks for having me. I was hoping that the professor might be able to touch a little bit more on fracking and what the environmental impacts might be with more fracking coming up. And there seems to be a growing body of evidence against fracking and the damage it might be doing. And hoping you could just touch a little bit about that.
Sure, sure. As I mentioned, we've been moving more heavily towards use of natural gas. That's why coal-fired power plants are actually, even without any federal regulations, they're closing anyway. We have, about a little less than 600 coal-fired power plants and about 1,500 total generating plants. Many of the older ones, many of these were built in the 50s and 60s. They're already nearing the end of their useful life. And what's happened is because of natural gas fracking, utilities are deciding to go with natural gas rather than coal and switching over. But Ruthie's quite correct. Fracking is not without its environmental impacts. For one thing, as I noted, natural gas is a fossil fuel, so there will be carbon pollution coming from that, albeit less than from coal. But there are other environmental concerns with fracking. Fracking involves injecting chemicals and water under high pressure underground to break up or fracture rock to release natural gas. So people are concerned about chemicals entering groundwater, though the fracking companies say they work very hard to try not to do that. A lot of people are concerned about the chemicals that are used. There's pressure, and the state of Michigan is now considering adding to regulations on fracking that the public ought to have a right to know about the chemicals that are used. So, yes, there are environmental consequences, particularly contamination of groundwater and chemicals that are used. And I guess to make a general point, every source of energy has some environmental and public health consequences, and as we consider what mix of energy sources we ought to have going forward, every source needs to be considered for its environmental impact, its health impacts, how much it costs, the job impacts, and so on. And quite frankly, that almost never happens. People say they favor, you know, like solar energy, or they favor wind energy, or they favor coal, or they favor nuclear, without comparing all of them across three or four major criteria. And so it's really important to understand natural gas fracking is not by itself a solution, because it also creates other problems.
So, you know, despite President Obama's call to expand and to develop more alternative energy, we're obviously still talking about using pipelines and and fracking and all this. Why is the U.S. presumed to be a leader in environmental issues when European countries, for example, have made a more aggressive effort toward alternative energy use?
Well, yes, you're quite right. Europe, in many ways, stands ahead of us. Norway, for example, I believe is up to about 90% of its energy derived from renewable sources. Some states within the United States are ahead of others in moving towards renewable energy. Again, California, most notably, many states have what's called a renewable energy portfolio, requiring a certain percentage of energy generated by power plants come from renewable sources. Wisconsin has a rather low limit of 10%, but some states are much, much higher than that. And so we see some real changes in that regard. And still, you're right. Many nations in Europe are ahead of the United States in using household trash, for example, for energy generation, and using wind and solar. Now, although it hasn't received a lot of attention, the Obama administration has been strongly encouraging. This is another component of the president's climate action plan, which is that he directs the Department of the Interior to make it easier to develop renewable energy sources on public lands in the West. There's some huge solar thermal power plants under construction on California desert, and wind plants elsewhere in the country. We'll probably see some wind plants offshore on the East Coast pretty soon. So all of those, you know, in the big picture, you want to push heavily for renewable sources. You want to develop new technologies. Wisconsin might be involved, for example, in biofuels. And what I see here is, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 decade change from relying on fossil fuels and nuclear to relying on a diversified mix of energy sources. And each state and each power company is going to have to decide, you know, what technologies to use. And the role of government, in part, is to encourage all these changes and to fund promising new technologies to the extent the private market can't do it by itself. So we're in a really exciting period of the way we use energy and new technologies being developed.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that this is an executive order. How soon will we actually see some action on the proposals?
Yeah, it's not so much an executive order as a decision to rely on
Sorry,
executive
yeah,
action.
That was a little bit different.
How soon? Well, this is going to all happen over the next couple of years. It takes a year or two to develop a major new EPA regulation. Some of the changes can take place immediately. For example, the president said he's already directing federal government agencies to make changes in, as I just said, in energy development policies on public lands and other ways. So I think many of these actions actually have already been underway for 5 years or 4.5 years of the Obama administration. In his very first year, the president spent under the Economic Renewal Act, about $80 billion was authorized for renewable energy and other changes. So a lot of this has been underway for some time. I think within the next year, you'll see quite a few changes. And then the big issue will be EPA regulation of existing coal-fired power plants. And they'll probably, my guess is they will set up standards that many older plants cannot meet. These will be carefully negotiated with the power plants themselves, probably on a state-by-state basis.
Okay. Professor Kraft, I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I hope you get well soon. That's Professor Kraft from UW-Green Bay, Professor of Public and Environmental Affairs. I'm Cynthia Schuster on the Ideas Network.